citizen army with a fist raised to the sky. Leading them is a mighty man with a mad rage in his eye. My name is James Connolly. I didn't come here to die, but to fight for the rights of the working class.
Hello, and welcome to another special edition of Plow and Stars. We are slowly working through Vladimir Lenin's State and Revolution. So today I'm going to be bringing you Chapter 5. But before I get to that, just a few brief notes. You can find us all on Twitter. You have our fearless leader, DM, also known as Commie Lawyer. He goes by @CatDadEternal. You can find Red Bernard @RedBernard. Myself, Doc Plague, just @I'mDocPlague. And then Pay My Rant, just @PayMyRant. You can find us on Spotify and iTunes, as well as Buzzsprout. We have a website, plowandstarspod.com, and you can just find us on Twitter, @plowandstars. You can send us a DM, any questions, or if you want to collaborate or anything like that. We have had a few people who have wanted to speak with us about different topics, and that's fantastic. We're working on some episodes like that. So if you have any ideas, please send them to us. You can also find us on Redbubble now. We have some t-shirts. The designs have been donated to us for use by @DumpCrow on Twitter as well. He's a fantastic artist. So without further ado, today I bring to you Chapter 5 of State and Revolution by Vladimir Lenin. From a superficial comparison of Marx's letter to Brack of May 5th, 1875, with Engels' letter to Babel on March 28th, 1875, which he examined above, it might appear that Marx was much more of a champion of the state than Engels, and that the difference of opinion between the two writers on the question of the state was very considerable. Engels suggested to Babel that all chatter about the state be dropped together, that the word state be eliminated from the program altogether, and the word community substituted for it. Engels even declared that the commune was a long state in the proper sense of the word. Yet Marx even spoke of the future state in communist society, i.e., he would seem to recognize the need for the state even under communism. But such a view would be fundamentally wrong. A closer examination shows that Marx and Engels' view on the state and its withering away were completely identical, and that Marx's expression quoted above refers to the state in the process of withering away. Clearly, there can be no question of specifying the moment of the future withering away, the more so since it will obviously be a lengthy process. The apparent difference between Marx and Engels is due to the fact that they dealt with different subjects and pursued different aims. Engels set out to show Babel, graphically, sharply, and in a broad outline, the utter absurdity of the current prejudices concerning the state, shared to no small degree by LaSalle. Marx only touched upon this question in passing, being interested in another subject, namely the development of communist society. The whole theory of Marx and the application of the theory of development in its most consistent, complete, considered, and pithy form to modern capitalism. Naturally, Marx was faced with the problem of applying this theory both to the forthcoming collapse of capitalism and to the future development of communism. On the basis of what facts, then, can the question of the future development of future communism be dealt with? On the basis of the fact that it has its origins in capitalism, that it develops historically from capitalism, that it is the result of the action with a social force to which capitalism gave birth, there is no trace of an attempt on Marx's part to make it a utopia, to indulge in idle guesswork about what cannot be known. Marx treated the question of communism in the same way as a naturalist would treat the question of the development of, say, a new biological variety. Once he knew that it had originated in such a way and was changing in such and such a definite direction. To begin with, Marx brushed aside the confusion of the Gotha program, brought into question of the relationship between state and society. He wrote, "Present-day society is capitalist society, which exists in all civilized countries, being more or less free from medieval admixture, more or less modified by the particular historical development of each country, more or less developed. On the other hand, the present-day state changes with a country's frontier. It is different in Prusso-German Empire from what it is in Switzerland, and different in England from what it is in the United States. The present-day state is therefore a fiction. Nevertheless, the different states of the different civilized countries, in spite of their motley diversity of form, all have this in common, that they are based on modern bourgeois society, only one more or less capitalistically developed, They have, therefore, also certain essential characteristics in common. In this sense, it is possible to speak of the present-day state in contrast with the future, in which the present root, bourgeois society, will have died off. The question then arises, what transformation will the state undergo in communist society? In other words, what social functions will remain in existence there that are analogous to present state functions? This question can only be answered scientifically, and one does not get to flea hop nearer to the problem by a thousandfold combination of the word people with the word state. After thus ridiculing all talk about the people's state, Marx formulated the question and gave warning, as it were, that those seeking a scientific answer to it should use only firmly established scientific data. The first fact that has been established most accurately by the whole theory of development by science as a whole, a fact that was ignored by the utopians and ignored by the present-day opportunists, who are afraid of the social revolution, that is, historically, there must be undoubtedly a special stage or a special phase of transition from capitalism to communism. Marx continued, between capitalist and communist society lies the period of the revolutionary transformation of the one into the other. Corresponding to this is also a political transition period in which the state can be nothing but the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat. Marx bases this conclusion on an analysis of the role played by the proletariat in modern capitalist society, on the data concerning the development of the society, and on the irreconcilability of the antagonistic interests of the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. Previously, the question was put as follows. To achieve its emancipation, the proletariat must overthrow the bourgeoisie, win political power, and establish its revolutionary dictatorship. Now, the question is put somewhat differently. The transition from capitalist society, which is developing towards communism, to communist society is impossible without a political transition period. And the state in this period can only be the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat. What then is the relation of this dictatorship to democracy? We have seen that the Communist Manifesto simply places side by side the two concepts, to raise the proletariat to the position of the ruling class, and to win the battle of democracy. On this basis of all that has been said above, it is possible to determine more precisely how democracy changes in the transition from capitalism to communism. In a capitalist society, providing it develops under the most favorable conditions, we have more or less complete democracy in the Democratic Republic. But this democracy is always hemmed in by narrow limits set by capitalist exploitation and consequently always remains, in effect, a democracy for the minority only, for the property classes, only for the rich. Freedom in capitalist society always remains about the same as it was in the ancient Greek republics, freedom for the slave owners. Owing to the condition of the capitalist exploitation, the modern wage slaves are so crushed by want and poverty that they cannot be bothered with democracy, cannot be bothered with politics. In the ordinary, peaceful course of the events, the majority of the population is debarred from participation in public and political life. The correctness of this statement is perhaps most clearly confirmed by Germany, because constitutional legality steadily endured there for a remarkably long time, nearly half a century, 1871 to 1914, and during this period, the Social Democrats were able to achieve far more than in other countries in the way of utilizing legality and organized a larger proportion of the workers into a political party than anywhere else in the world. What is the largest proportion of politically conscious and active wage slaves that so far has been recorded in capitalist society? 1 million members of the Socialist Democratic Party out of 15 million wage workers. 3 million organized in trade unions out of 15 million. Democracy for an insignificant minority, democracy for the rich, that is, the democracy of capitalist society. If we look more closely into the machinery of capitalist democracy, we see everywhere in the petty, supposedly petty, details of the suffrage, residential qualifications, exclusion of women, etc., in the technique of the representative institutions, in the actual obstacles to the right of assembly, public buildings are not for paupers, in the purely capitalist organization of the daily press, etc., etc., we see restriction after restriction upon democracy. These restrictions, exceptions, exclusions, obstacles for the poor seem slight, especially in the eyes of one who has never known want himself and has never been in close contact with the oppressed classes in their mass life. And 9 out of 10, if not 99 out of 100, bourgeois, publicists, and politicians come under this category. But in their sum total, these restrictions exclude and squeeze out the poor from politics, from the active participation in democracy. Marx grasped this essence of capitalist democracy splendidly in analyzing the experience of the commune. He said that the oppressed are allowed once every few years to decide which particular representative of the oppressed class represent and repress them in parliament. But from this capitalist democracy that is inevitably narrow and stealthily pushes aside the poor and is therefore hypocritical and false through and through, forward development does not simply proceed directly and smoothly towards greater and greater democracy, as the liberal professors and petty bourgeois opportunists would have us believe. No, forward development, i.e. development towards communism, proceeds through the dictatorship of the proletariat and cannot do otherwise, for the resistance of the capitalist exploiters cannot be broken by anyone else or in any way. And the dictatorship of the proletariat, i.e. the organization of the vanguard of the oppressed and the ruling class for the purpose of suppressing the oppressors, cannot result merely in an expansion of democracy. Simultaneously with an immense expansion of democracy, which for the first time becomes democracy for the poor, democracy for the people, and not democracy for the money bags, the dictatorship of the proletariat imposes a series of restrictions on the freedom of the oppressors, the exploiters, and the capitalists. We must suppress them in order to free humanity from wage slavery. Their resistance must be crushed by force. It is clear that there is no freedom and no democracy where there is suppression and where there is violence. Engels expressed this splendidly in his letter to Babel when he said that, as the reader will remember, the proletariat needs the state, not in the interests of freedom, but in order to hold down its adversaries, and as soon as it becomes possible to spark freedom, the state, as such, ceases to exist. Democracy, for the vast majority of people, and suppression by force, i.e. exclusion from democracy, of the exploiters and oppressors of the people, this is the change democracy undergoes during the transition from capitalism to communism. Only in communist society, when the resistance of the capitalists has disappeared, when there are new classes, i.e., when there is no distinction between the members of society as regards their relations to the social means of production, only then the state ceases to exist, and it becomes possible to speak of freedom. Only then will a truly complete democracy become possible and be realized, a democracy without any exception whatever, and only then will the democracy begin to wither away, owing to the simple fact that freed from capitalist slavery, from untold horrors, savagery, absurdities, and infamies of capitalist exploitation, people will gradually become accustomed to observing the elementary rules of social intercourse and have been known for centuries and repeated for thousands of years in all copybook maxims. They'll become accustomed to observing them without force, without coercion, without subordination, without the special apparatus for coercion called the state. The expression, "the state withers away," is very well chosen, for it indicates both the gradual and spontaneous nature of the process. Only habit can, and undoubtedly will, have such an effect. For we see around us, on millions of occasions, how readily people become accustomed to observing the necessary rules of social intercourse when there is no exploitation, when there is nothing that arouses indignation, evokes protest and revolt, and creates the need for suppression. And so, in capitalist society, we have a democracy that is curtailed, wretched, false, a democracy only for the rich, for the minority. The dictatorship of the proletariat, the period of transition to communism, will, for the first time, create democracy for the people, for the majority, along with the necessary suppression of the exploiters, of the minority. Communism alone is capable of providing really complete democracy, and the more complete it is, the sooner it will become a necessary and wither away of its own accord. In other words, under capitalism, we will have the state in the proper sense of the word, that is, a special machine for the suppression of one class by another, and what is more, of the majority by the minority. Naturally, to be successful, such an undertaking as the systemic oppression of the exploited majority by the exploiting minority calls for the utmost ferocity and savagery in the matter of suppressing. It calls for seas of blood, through which mankind is actually wading its way in slavery, serfdom, and wage labor. Furthermore, during the transition from capitalism to communism, suppression is still necessary, but it is now the suppression of the exploiting minority by the exploited majority. A special apparatus, a special machine for suppression, the state, is still necessary, but this is now a transitional state. It is no longer a state in the proper sense of the word, for the suppression of the minority of exploiters by the majority of the wage slaves of yesterday's comparatively so easy, simple, and natural a task that will entail far less bloodshed than the suppression of the rising of slaves, serfs, and wage laborers, as it will cost mankind far less, and is compatible with the extension of democracy to such an overwhelming majority of the population that the need for a special machine of suppression will begin to disappear. Naturally, the exploiters are unable to suppress the people without a highly complex machine for performing this task. But the people can suppress the exploiters even with a very simple machine, almost without a machine, without a special apparatus by the simple organization of the armed people, such as the Soviets of workers and soldiers' deputies, we would remark running ahead. Lastly, only communism makes the state absolutely unnecessary, for there is nobody to be suppressed. Nobody in the sense of a class of systemic struggle against a definite section of the population. We are not utopians and do not in the least deny the possibility and inevitability of excesses on the part of individual persons, or the need to stop such excesses. In the first place, however, no special machine, no special apparatus of suppression is needed for this. This will be done by armed people themselves, as simply as readily as any crowd of civilized people, even in the modern society, interferes to put stop to a scuffle or to prevent a woman from being assaulted. And secondly, we know that the fundamental social cause of excesses, which consists in the violation of the rules of social intercourse, is the exploitation of the people, their want, and their poverty. With the removal of this chief cause, excesses will inevitably begin to wither away. We do not know how quickly and in what succession, but we do know that they will wither away. With their withering away, the state will also wither away. Without building utopias, Marx defined more fully what can be defined now regarding this future, namely the differences between lower and higher phases, levels or stages of communist society. In the Critique of the Gotha Program, Marx goes into detail to disprove LaSalle's idea that under socialism, the worker will receive the undiminished or full product of his labor. Marx shows that from the whole idea of the social labor of society, there must be deducted a reserve fund, a fund for the expansion of production, a fund for the replacement of the wear and tear of machinery, and so on. Then from the means of consumption must be deducted a fund for administrative expenses, for schools, hospitals, old people's homes, and so on. Instead of LaSalle's hazy, obscure general phrase, the full product of his labor to the worker, Marx makes a sober estimate of exactly how socialist society will have to manage its affairs. Marx proceeds to make a concrete analysis of the conditions of life of a society in which there will be no capitalism and says, "What we have to deal with here in analyzing the program of the Workers' Party is a communist society, not as it has developed on its own foundations, but on the contrary, just as it emerges from capitalist society, which is thus, in every respect, economically, morally, and intellectually, still stamped with the birthmarks of the old society from whose womb it comes. It is this communist society, which has just emerged into the light of day out of the womb of capitalism, and which, in every respect, stamped with the birthmarks of the old society, that Marx terms the first or lower phase of communist society. The means of production are no longer the private property of individuals. The means of production belong to the whole of society. Every member of society, performing a certain part of the socially necessary work, receives a certificate from society to the effect that he has done a certain amount of work. And with this certificate, he receives from the public store of consumer goods a corresponding quantity of products. After a deduction is made from the amount of labor which goes to the public fund, every worker, therefore, receives from society just as much he has given to it. Equality, apparently, reigns supreme. But when LaSalle, having in view such a social order, usually called socialism, but termed by Marx the first phase of communism, says that this is equitable distribution, that this is the equal right of all to an equal product of labor, LaSalle is mistaken, and Marx exposes this mistake. Hence, the equal right, says Marx, in this case, still certainly conforms to bourgeois law, which, like all law, implies inequality. All law is an application of an equal measure to different people who are, in fact, not alike, are not equal to one another. This is why the equal right is violation of equality and injustice. In fact, everyone having performed as much social labor as another receives an equal share of the social product after the above-mentioned deductions. But people are not alike. One is strong, another weak. One is married, another is not. One has children, another has less, and so on. And the conclusion Marx draws is, with an equal performance of labor, and hence an equal share of the social consumption fund, one will, in fact, receive more than another. One will be richer than another, and so on. To avoid these defects, the right, instead of being equal, would have to be unequal. The first phase of communism, therefore, cannot yet provide justice and equality. Differences and unjust differences in wealth will still persist, but the exploitation of man by man will have become impossible because it will be impossible to seize the means of production. the factories, machines, land, etc., and make them private property. In smashing LaSalle's petty bourgeois vague phrases about equality and justice in general, Marx shows the course of development of communist society, which is compelled to abolish first only the injustice of the means of production seized by individuals, and which is unable at once to eliminate the other injustice, which consists of the distribution of consumer goods according to the amount of labor performed, and not according to needs. The vulgar economists, including the bourgeois professors and our Tugin, constantly reproach the socialists with forgetting the inequality of people and with dreaming of eliminating this equality. Such a reproach, as we see, only proves the extreme ignorance of the bourgeois ideologists. Marx not only most scrupulously takes account of the inevitable inequality of man, but he also takes into account the fact that the mere conversion of the means of production into the common property of the whole society, commonly called socialism, does not remove the defects of distribution and equality of bourgeois laws, which continues to prevail so long as products are divided according to the amount of labor performed. Continuing, Marx says, "But these defects are inevitable in the first phase of communist society, as it is when it has just emerged, after prolonged birth pangs from a capitalist society. Law can never be higher than the economic structure of society and its cultural development conditioned thereby. And so, in the first phase of communist society, usually called socialism, bourgeois law is not abolished in its entirety, but is only part, only in proportion to the economic revolution so far attained, i.e., only in respect to the means of production. Bourgeois law recognizes them as the private property of individuals. Socialism converts them into common property. To that extent, and to that extent alone, bourgeois law disappears. However, it persists as far as its other parts are concerned. It persists in the capacity of regulator, determining factor, in the distribution of products and the allotment of labor among the members of society. The social principle, he who does not work shall not eat, is already realized. The other socialist principle, an amount of products for an equal amount of labor, is also already realized. But this is not yet communism, and it does not yet abolish bourgeois law, which gives unequal individuals in return for unequal, really unequal, amounts of labor, equal amounts of products. This is a defect, says Marx, but it is unavoidable in the first phase of communism, for if we are not to indulge in utopianism, we must not think that having overthrown capitalism, people will at once learn to work for society without any rules of law. Besides, the abolition of capitalism does not immediately create the economic prerequisites for such a change. Now, there are no other rules than those of bourgeois law. To this extent, therefore, there still remains the need for a state, which, while safeguarding the common ownership of the means of production, would safeguard equality in labor and the distribution of products. The state withers away insofar as there are no longer any capitalists, any classes, and consequently no class can be suppressed. But the state has not yet completely withered away, since there still remains a safeguarding bourgeois law, which sanctifies actual inequality. For the state to wither away completely, complete communism is necessary. Marx continues, "In a higher phase of communist society, after the enslaving subordination of the individual to the division of labor, and with it also to the antithesis between mental and physical labor, has vanished, the labor has become not only a livelihood, but the life's prime want. After the productive forces have increased with the all-around development of the individual, and all of the springs of cooperative wealth flow more abundantly, only then can the narrow horizon of bourgeois law be left behind in its entirety and society inscribed on its banners. From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. Only now we can fully appreciate the correctness of Engels' remarks, mercilessly ridiculing the absurdity of combining the words freedom and state. So long as the state exists, there is no freedom. When there is freedom, there will be no state. The economic basis for the complete withering away of the state is such a high state of development of communism, at which the antithesis between the mental and physical labor disappears, at which there consequently disappears one of the principal sources of modern social inequality, a source, moreover, which cannot on any account be removed immediately by the mere conversion of the means of production into public property, by the mere expropriation of the capitalists. This expropriation will make it possible for the productive forces to develop to a tremendous extent. And when we see how incredibly capitalism is already retarding this development, when we see how much progress could be achieved on the basis on the basis of the level of technique already attained, we are entitled to say with the fullest confidence that the expropriation of the capitalists will inevitably result in an enormous development of the productive forces of human society. But how rapidly this development will proceed, how soon it will reach the point of breaking away from division of labor, of doing away with the antithesis between mental and physical labor, of transforming labor into life's prime want, we do not and cannot know. That is why we are entitled to speak only of the inevitable withering away of the state, emphasizing the protracted nature of this process and its dependence upon the rapidity of development of the higher phase of communism, and leaving the question of the time required for, or the concrete forms of, the withering away quite open, because there is no material for answering these questions. The state will be able to wither away completely when society adopts the rule, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. I.e., when people have become so accustomed to observing the fundamental rules of social intercourse, and when their labor has become so productive they will voluntarily work according to their ability, the narrow horizon of bourgeois law, which compels one to calculate with the heartlessness of a Shylock whether one has not worked half an hour more than anybody else, this narrow horizon will then be left behind. There will then be no need for society, in distributing the products, to regulate the quantity to be received by each. Each will take freely according to his needs. From the bourgeois point of view, it is easy to declare that such a social order is sheer utopia, and to sneer at the socialists for promising everyone the right to receive from society, without any control over the labor of the individual citizen, any quantity of truffles, cars, pianos, etc. Even to this day, most bourgeois savants confine themselves to sneering in this way, thereby betraying both their ignorance and their selfish defense of capitalism. Ignorance, for it has never entered the head of any socialist to promise that the higher phase of the development of communism will arrive. As for the great socialist forecasts that it will arrive, it presupposes that the present ordinary run of people who, like the seminary student in Pomyovsky's stories, are capable of damaging the stocks of the public wealth just for fun, and of demanding the impossible. Until the higher phase of communism arrives, the socialists demand the strictest control by society and by the state over the measure of labor and the measure of consumption. But this control must start with the expropriation of the capitalists, with the establishment of the workers' controls over the capitalists, and must be exercised not by a state of bureaucrats, but by the state of the armed workers. The selfish defense of the capitalism by the bourgeois ideologists and their hangers-on, like the Saratellis, Chernovs, and company, consists in that they are substituting arguing and talk about the distant future for the vital and burning question of the present-day politics, namely the expropriation of the capitalists, the conversion of all citizens into workers and the employees of one huge syndicate, the whole state, and the complete subordination of the entire work of the syndicate to a genuinely democratic state, the state of the Soviets of workers and the soldiers' deputies. In fact, when I learned a professor, followed by the Philistine, followed in turn by the Saratellis and the Chernovs, talk of wild utopias, of the demagogic promises of the Bolsheviks, of the impossibility of introducing socialism, it is the higher stage or phase of communism he has in mind, which no one has ever promised or even thought to introduce because, generally speaking, it cannot be introduced. And this brings us to the question of the scientific distinction between socialism and communism, which Engels touched on in the above-quoted argument about the incorrectness of the name of the social democrat. Politically, the distinction between the first, or lower, and the higher phase of communism will in time probably be tremendous. But it would be ridiculous to recognize this distinction now under capitalism, as only individual anarchists, perhaps, could invest it with primary importance. If there are still people among the anarchists who have learned nothing about the Plekhanov conversion of the Kropotkins, of Grave, Cornelissen, and other stars of anarchism into social chauvinists or anarcho-trenchists, as Guy, one of the few anarchists who have still preserved a sense of humor and conscience, has put it. But the scientific distinction between socialism and communism is clear. What is usually called socialism is termed by Marx at the first or lower phase of communist society. Insofar as the means of production become common property, the word communism is also applicable here, providing we do not forget that this is not complete communism. The great significance of Marx's explanation is that here, too, he consistently applies materialist dialectics, the theory of development, in regards to communism as something which develops out of capitalism. Instead of scholastically invented, concocted definitions and fruitless disputes over words, what is socialism? What is communism? Marx gives an analysis of what might be called the stages of the economic maturity of communism. In the first stage, or first phase, communism cannot as yet be fully mature economically and entirely free from traditions or vestiges of capitalism. Hence the interesting phenomenon that communism in its first phase retains the narrow horizon of the bourgeois law. Of course, bourgeois law, in regard to the distribution of consumer goods, inevitably presupposes the existence of the bourgeois state, for law is nothing without apparatus capable of enforcing the observance of the rules of law. It follows that under communism, there remains for a time not only bourgeois law, but even the bourgeois state without the bourgeoisie. This may sound like a paradox or simply a dialectical conundrum of which Marxism is often accused by people who have not taken the slightest trouble to study its extraordinarily profound content. But in fact, remnants of the old surviving in the new confront us in life at every step, both in nature and in society. And Marx did not arbitrarily insert a scrap of bourgeois law into communism, but indicated what is economically and politically inevitable in a society emerging out of the womb of capitalism. Democracy means equality. The significance of the proletariat struggle for equality and of the equality as a slogan will be clear if we correctly interpret it as meaning the abolition of classes. But democracy means only formal equality. As soon as equality is achieved for all members of society in relation to ownership of the means of production, that is, equality of labor and wages, humanity will inevitably be confronted with the question of advancing further from formal equality into actual equality, i.e. to the operation of rule from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. By what stages, by what means, of what practical measures of humanity will proceed to this supreme aim, we do not know and cannot know. But it is important to realize how infinitely mendacious is the extraordinary bourgeois concept of socialism as something lifeless, rigid, fixed, once and for all, whereas in reality, only socialism will be the beginning of a rapid, genuine, truly mass-forward movement, embracing first the majority and then the whole of the population in all spheres of public and private life. Democracy is of enormous importance to the working class in its struggle against the capitalists for its emancipation. But democracy is by no means a boundary not to be overstepped. It is only one of the stages on the road from feudalism to capitalism and from capitalism to communism. Democracy is a form of the state. It represents, on one hand, the organized, systemic use of force against persons, but on the other hand, it signifies the formal recognition of equality of citizens, equal right of all to determine the structure of and to administer the state. This, in turn, results in the fact that at a certain stage in the development of democracy, it first wields together the class that wages a revolutionary struggle against capitalism, the proletariat, and enables it to crush, smash to atoms, wipe off the face of the earth, the bourgeoisie. Even the Republican bourgeois state machine, the standing army, the police, and the bureaucracy, and to substitute them for a more democratic state machine. But a state machine, nevertheless, in the shape of the armed workers who proceed to form a militia involving the entire population. Here, the quantity turns into quality. Such a degree of democracy implies overstepping the boundaries of bourgeois society and beginning its socialist reorganization. If really all take part in the administration of the state, capitalism cannot retain its hold. The development of capitalism, in turn, creates the preconditions that enable really all to take part in the administration of the state. Some of these preconditions are universal literacy, which has already been achieved in a number of the most advanced capitalist countries, then the training and disciplining of millions of workers by the huge, complex, socialized stratus of the postal service, railways, big factories, large-scale commerce, banking, etc., etc. Given these economic preconditions, it is quite possible, after the overthrow of the capitalists and the bureaucrats, to proceed immediately, overnight, to replace them in the control of the production and distribution, in the work of keeping account of labor products by armed workers, by the whole of the armed population. The question of control and accounting should not be confused with the question of the scientifically trained staff of engineers, ergonomists, and so on. These gentlemen are working today in obedience to the wishes of the capitalists and will work even better tomorrow in obedience to the wishes of the armed workers. Accounting and control, that is mainly what is needed for the smooth working of the proper functioning of the first phase of communist society. All citizens are transformed into hired employees of the state, which consists of armed workers. All citizens becomes employees and workers of a single countrywide state syndicate. All that is required is that they should work equally, do their proper share of work, get equal pay. The accounting and control necessary for this have been simplified by capitalism to the utmost and reduced to the extraordinarily simple operations, which any literate person can perform, of supervising and recording, knowledge of the four rules of arithmetic, and using the appropriate receipts. When the majority of the people began independently and everywhere to keep such accounts and exercise such control over the capitalists, now converted into employees, and over the intellectual gentry who preserve their capitalist habits, this control will really become universal, general, and popular, and there will be no getting away from it. There will be nowhere to go. The whole of society will become a single office and a single factory with the equality of labor and pay. But this factory discipline, which the proletariat, after defeating the capitalists, after overthrowing the exploiters, will extend to the whole of society, is by no means our ideal or our ultimate goal. This is our only necessary step for thoroughly cleansing society of all infamies and abominations of capitalist exploitation and for further progress. From the moment all members of society, or at least the vast majority, have learned to administer the state themselves, have taken this work into their own hands, have organized control over this insignificant capitalist minority, over the gentry who wish to preserve their capitalist habits, and over the workers who have been thoroughly corrupted by capitalism, from this moment, the need for government of any kind begins to disappear altogether. The more complete the democracy, the nearer the moment it becomes necessary. The more democratic the state, which consists of armed workers, and which is no longer a state in the proper sense of the word, the more rapidly every form of the state begins to wither away. For when all have learned to administer, and actually to independently administer social production, independently keep accounts and exercise control over the parasites, the sons of the wealthy, the swindlers, and other guardians of capitalist tradition, the escape from this popular accounting and control will inevitably become so incredibly difficult, such as a rare exception, and will probably be accompanied by such swift and severe punishment, for the armed workers are practical men and not sentimental intellectuals, and they scarcely allow anyone to trifle with them. That is the necessity of observing the simple fundamental rules of the community, and will very soon become a habit. Then the door will be thrown wide open for the transition from the first phase of communist society to its higher phase, and with it to the complete withering away of the state. Thank you again for listening to Chapter 5 of Vladimir Lenin's State and Revolution.